The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play the country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
And then welcome along to the Football Show. Joe Malloy here, Dan McDonald as well. Coming up, we'll talk to Rob Harris of Associated Press about the Manchester City situation, which obviously is quite dramatic to say the least. We are keeping an eye on Chelsea against Manchester United. Suddenly, fourth place Chelsea are home and hosed in this Champions League race, Dan, even though they are trailing 1-0 to an Anthony Martial header. Second half has just started. It was a really good goal for people just tuning in. Wan-Bissaka down the right-hand side. Sort of twisted and turned and pirouetted a bit because he was under pressure, hooked in across, and the Martial header was excellent. We don't actually always see him attack the ball that aggressively, Martial, but he really attacked it there, a glancing header into the far post, and Manchester United 1-0 up. Chelsea had a very good first 45 minutes.
Yeah, missed several chances and had been on top, but didn't really, you know, didn't convert them, and they left themselves vulnerable to the sucker punch. So, I mean, it should set up a good second half now. You'd imagine it's going to try, Manchester United just sit back, try and absorb some of the pressure and maybe try and break away and grab a second if they can, but even early days, but you'd imagine it's going to be Chelsea taking the initiative for most of it.
Sky Sports News were selling this game all afternoon in a big way. They had a presence at Stamford Bridge all day, but their main selling point was that this was Jamie Carragher and Roy Keane reunited.
They've had some moments, haven't they?
Well, there was montages all day of their best bits.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How could I miss out on this today?
Well, you know, it was. I mean, look, it's always mildly amusing. When, the first time it came on in the office, everyone laughed.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe time number 10, it was a bit much. But that's we're talking about a rolling news channel. You're not meant to sit there and watch it all day.
Maybe Carragher should get keen on his podcast. That'd be good.
That'd be good. Yeah.
I don't know if you heard Carragher's podcast. If people have, it's pretty good.
I heard him interviewing Steven Gerrard.
Yeah, there's one with Michael Owen. It's excellent. Actually, you did a very good piece in here. Was it you that did the Michael Owen interview?
It's been in a few times.
Yeah, there's one in particular, you know, where he really opened up. But this Carragher one, naturally, because they're your ex-teammates, and they were very good mates, and just a really good. It's just a really good dynamic to the whole piece, you know, to the interview. It's sort of over an hour or so, just Owen's confidence, but also speaking about, you know, how he thought he'd rejoin Liverpool after he came back from Madrid, and his belief that he had, and basically then speaking about how he declined so badly and how he felt he was the best in the world at 18. He was better than everyone.
Sociopathic level of self-belief.
Yeah, like, it's extraordinary and it really shines through. But Carragher, who roomed with him at various times, actually put some things, something he'd nearly wanted to say to him. Like, why did you do that? What happened there?
Good.
What was going on?
Okay.
And Owen sort of, you know, explained his stance and even spoke about how Owen's people had decided when he was 17, 18, well, you're going to be the nice guy. This is your image. And as Carragher sort of said, and Owen said, well, you know, that wasn't necessarily you. You know, that as in, like, he went for nights out and, you know, he was no angel, but his image was being crafted in a particular way. So it's basically two mates having a chat. And as a result, it's very good. But anyway, I'm not sure if Roy will be signing up for that.
He might twist his arm.
You never know.
I think he was in here a few times. He was in here in the book with Nathan. The time I talked to him, I was quite struck by him talking about coming back from France 98 and the extent to which overnight fame had hit him. Even to the point that his older brother, he remembered sitting like in the family living room and just caught his brother looking at him after the World Cup in 98, almost like, what's happened here?
Yeah.
You're like a global superstar now.
Yeah.
And him always having to say, well, you shut up, it's just me.
Yeah,
come on.
I know.
But then struggling actually to make friends for the next 15 years. He was saying it's only now, when he goes to race meetings, he's very obviously big into his racing, but it's only now that he's gone from quite reclusive and guarded and not wanting to talk to people to quite open and enjoying talking to people and feeling there's less of an agenda. I guess his fame has diminished somewhat, so people can talk to him on a semi-normal basis now. So quite interesting.
I mean
that level of fame is wonderful in many ways, but it's also incredibly isolating.
Well, particularly when it comes to so early, you can imagine as well that he didn't have that period of normality in his life, you know. And even you sense listening to Carragher and various people that, okay, Carragher was almost a bigger star now than he was nearly as a player in some respects, and so probably was able to go about his normal business to a degree in his younger days. And I mean, you saw even with Wayne Rooney, who came along, who was the next one, and he kept tripping up because he tried to be normal. And in many respects, you know, that was his mistake. And it's very interesting. Like Troy Parrott has obviously just turned 18, and you know, you have to tread very carefully with everything that you do. You know, and every aspect of your life is analysed very closely. And
it will help Troy Parrott enormously that he's not English.
I would have thought so. Yeah, I would have thought so. But it's just something that he's going to have to be conscious of. You know, that like I think wasn't there a thing a couple of years ago that when Dele Alli came on the scene, you know, the new star, but straight away there were stories of like that various papers and people were sort of, you know, they start to basically trace you. See, well, what's your story? What's he up to? What's he really like? You know, and that's, I guess Owen's people back then were trying to get ahead of it because they knew so early he was going to be a star that they were making plans as early as possible. You know, whereas sometimes it's the overnight sensation that finds it hard. I think actually James McLean has spoken about it quite well before, that when he went from Derry to Sunderland, all of a sudden everything he'd ever said on social media in the past, you know, well, previously he was broadcasting to his mates or whatever, suddenly now had the potential to become a national story. And I don't think there's anything that can really prepare anyone for that. They can try and prepare for it, but I don't think anything really, you know, there must be nothing that compares with just that inability to think about going to the shop or something without having to plan it ahead. And you kind of wonder how people get driven indoors and away from into their gated communities. I mean, part of that is unfortunately quite understandable.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, Carragher and Keane this evening have not had a huge amount to talk about. The Martial goal, and then the only other thing really to mention is Harry Maguire, probably lucky enough to still be on the field, I think. Although VAR looked at it and said no. Basically, there was
not an outrage.
No, it's not an outrage. Sorry, I'm going over the top. He fell back in a coming together with the Chelsea player and basically jabbed out his right foot to what you very discreetly, Dan, called the groin area of the opposition player. I mean, in reality, he studded him in the balls.
Well, there you go. I wanted to, after 9 o'clock, I'd say that, obviously.
But violent conduct was the VAR verdict. Although, if it was me who had been on the end of those studs,
you'd be raging.
I would have said that was violent and it was conduct, therefore.
Yeah. Alex, you've seen them given. You know, you've seen red cards given for similar offences.
This would be a big win for Manchester United, who would go up to 7th in the table. They would suddenly be 3 points behind Chelsea in 4th and only 2 points behind Spurs in 5th.
Which could be the big position.
As we'll hear, could be absolutely fine. So this could put United right back in the conversation if things stay as they are. 54 minutes.
The table is so congested that any team in that sort of middle rump that puts 3 or 4 wins together is suddenly going to be in contention, particularly if 5th somehow comes into play.
Chelsea at the post. Play is halted.
Offside, I think.
Yeah, no, it sure is. It sure is. And we'll hear from Heung-min Son later on, who was talking to Nathan Murphy, scored the winner at Villa Park yesterday. Pearl Bjorn Engels made a dreadful mistake in the final moments. A bouncing ball. It was like something you'd see at AstroTurf.
Yeah.
Bouncing ball. He's the last man. You don't try and control a bouncing ball with the sole of your boot. Stuck that foot out, skidded under. Suddenly Son said, okay,
I'll have some of that.
Absolutely. I mean, even if Engels had just booted the ball away, it would have been fine at that stage.
I wouldn't be talking about it now, that's for sure.
No.
But they're trained to do that, though. That's the thing. When it works and they execute it perfectly, that's the whole, you know, we applaud.
He gave away a penalty as well. Didn't have a great day. Although, you know, I liked all his teammates come over to him afterwards and consoled him, said not to worry.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice. So earlier on, we spoke to Rob Harris. Rob Harris is at Stamford Bridge, hence we had to record this chat of Associated Press. He has been all over financial fair play for some time now, which has been in effect since 2011. Manchester City obviously finding themselves very much on the wrong side of this. They are facing and they are appealing a 2-year ban from the Champions League. The genesis of this most recent infringement, because this first arose in 2014, but the most recent infringement, Der Spiegel had, there were emails which were hacked and found their way to Der Spiegel. They showed a number of things. So one of the big charges, this is back in November and 2018, and UEFA launched an investigation in March of last year. So for instance, some of what Manchester City are accused to have been up to includes the sponsorship deal with Etihad, for instance. Have we got a goal?
We have a goal for Chelsea. Zuma from a corner after a great chance prior to that where Pedro had a shot blocked away, but the subsequent corner they've stuck it away.
Okay.
Unmarked. Bottom corner. I'm not sure if there's going to be a VAR appeal or anything like that. Harry Maguire's going mad, but it looks to be a goal. Who knows?
One all, 55 minutes. So back to Rob Harris. One of the main charges, as I said, concerns the Etihad sponsorship of Manchester City. So basically, Etihad, for instance, paid Manchester City £67 million in sponsorship. And private emails, which appeared in Der Spiegel, suggested that actually of that £67 million, only £8 million came from Etihad. The other £57 million pretty much came courtesy of Sheikh Mansour. Now, owners cannot bail out their teams in that way. That goes against financial fair play. So that is one of the big accusations, and I put that to Rob Harris of Associated
Press. No goal,
Press
by the way.
Oh, hang on.
No goal.
No goal.
No goal. It's a push. There's a push. It's
ruining football, and it's ruining my intro.
I know, I'm sorry, but I know you want to throw it to the piece, but you can't have people believing that it's one all for a period of time, so it's no goal.
I thought I'd done a really nice job.
That was an excellent intro.
Bloody
But
hell.
There was no goal.
It's ruining football.
And more to the point.
Who pushed?
Your intros. Brandon Williams got pushed. I'm not sure who actually committed the push, but it looked like a fair decision.
And another, it took too long. I resumed the intro.
I assumed you were actually making the intro somewhat long-winded so we could actually find out.
You can jump on, you can get lost too, actually. The intro was to the point.
Yeah, let's just go to Rob Harris, really.
So again, £67 million, Etihad only gave £8 million of that. It turns out Sheikh Mansour went, do you know what, here's the other £57 million, which is obviously completely against the rules. So that is one of the big accusations. As I put to Rob Harris of Associated Press.
Yeah, and effectively it's also disguising the true source of income as well. So not only just relying massively on sponsorship linked to the Abu Dhabi ownership, but also, as UEFA would see it, what we saw from what the leaks appear to show was a apparent attempt to circumvent the rules by disguising the source of income. And City have never disputed the authenticity of the documents. They do deny wrongdoing, but they've never actually gone through the specifics, in public at least, to tell us why these emails were being sent to suggest one part of a Sheikh Mansour business world was effectively, appeared to be at least, repaying elements of that sponsorship back to Etihad, obviously the main sponsor of the club.
And is this regarded as the most damning aspect of the investigation, Rob? This, say, £57 million of the £67 million Etihad sponsorship coming from Sheikh Mansour?
I mean, what we don't know from Friday's statement are the specifics that UEFA actually ultimately effectively found City guilty on. We just have this reference to the overstating of the revenue and of the break-even information. We obviously piece it back from the leaked internal correspondence, which has not been disputed by City, that also showed things like image rights deals, where they're selling off the image rights to a company with links, again, allegedly back to the ownership. So many elements ultimately to try to inflate the income in a way that was already under question because they rely so much on sponsors from Abu Dhabi, where of course the ownership is from. These are obviously assessed for fair value by UEFA. They determine if it was a company unconnected to the ownership who wanted the naming rights or certain sponsorships. They assess, well, what would they actually pay? What is City worth on the open market? But ultimately, while City have previously had their case judged in 2014, and some of this does cover that period again, it's all about that new information that helped to shed a light, really, on what apparently were the dealings going on back in Abu Dhabi, funneling money around.
You mentioned 2014, Rob. So in 2014, UEFA determined that City had a deficit of €180 million over that two-year period, which was vastly in excess of the €45 million permitted. So €180 million was their deficit. They're allowed €45 million. That is a hell of a deficit. The punishment in 2014 was a fine. So how have we gone from a fine, which frankly I'm sure Sheikh Mansour looked at and said, do your worst, how have we gone from that to a two-year Champions League ban?
Yeah, and obviously we don't know, again, the full details, but it obviously points to the judicial side at UEFA really believing it's a serious breach, as they say in their statement, of the rules. And they mentioned things like the lack of cooperation from City. I mean, there was a sense I got at a time that they were basically not really answering the questions that UEFA investigators wanted answering. With the public position for so long was the fact we don't comment on this type of information that's being gained, the internal correspondence. So yeah, this would point to something a lot more than just breaching the break even and spending too much, but actually the conduct as well that was connected to that. So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously not unknown for teams to be banned from European competitions by UEFA for financial fair play. And, you know, contrary to the narrative that some would like to believe sometimes, that it's about the cartel keeping out the you know, clubs trying to sort of break through. A lot of financial fair play is about making sure clubs are paying their debts, they're meeting their tax bills, they're paying the players. There's all these club licensing rules, even things like ensuring you have youth teams ultimately to ensure you can play in the Champions League. So yeah, it's a lot more than just about how much you can lose or how much you know you can spend. But yeah, I mean, what we want, we will now get a lot more detail as this case heads to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and ultimately at the end of it we should see a lot more of the what led to the ban, if it indeed it survives at the end of the case as well.
Yeah, well, indeed, I'm sure there'll be some handsomely paid lawyers involved in this case. As I mentioned, financial fair play was introduced in 2011. I think a minority had high hopes for its scope. Is this Manchester City ban comparable, with any other bans over the last 8 years?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, teams have been banned or various, you know, ways that you know, they don't participate. I mean, the AC Milan case from last year is obviously one of the bigger clubs as well. UEFA initially did ban Milan for 2 seasons from Europe. They appealed it, and effectively Milan accepted the 1 year ban, so they're out of the Europa League this season. That obviously also showed us how places are redistributed in Serie A to account for a team dropping out, because England should still get its 4 Champions League places, because they would only lose it in the case of a team that was eligible rejecting the chance to play in Europe.
I mentioned the 2014 incident. It's quite staggering that Manchester City didn't, after that fairly blunt warning, didn't clean up their act.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of this is about how the club acts, what you know, their conduct, the officials. And of course, many of the officials are still in place. They're officials who we see from internal correspondence were celebrating the death of one of the UEFA investigators, were sort of basically saying they could, you know, do what they liked with UEFA. They would spend millions on lawyers to put up against them. So this certainly showed City's belief that, you know, they could take on the rules. But let's step back. You'll struggle to find anywhere a clear articulation from Manchester City with their views against financial fair play. So from the early days of the ownership, that was before financial fair play was even officially introduced, to around the time that they first had to comply, to the time of the first sanctioning, there is no Manchester City public position saying this is what we think is wrong with FFP, this is what we think should change about it. You know, it's just stuff that's sort of filtered out. And you know, you contrast that, say, to Liverpool, where you know, John Henry made very clear in his early days as the owner, one of the reasons they bought Liverpool was because of the existence of financial fair play. But never has there been a clear, detailed position against FFP, just sort of general criticism of processes that they've been judged by.
Yeah. You mentioned, by the way, that celebration of Jean-Luc Dehaene was the former Prime Minister of Belgium, who was a former chair of the IC, the investigative chamber. He passed away. He was survived by his wife and his 4 children. And Der Spiegel quoted one of the members of Manchester City's inner sanctum in an internal email saying, "One down, 6 to go of the IC. David Conn in The Guardian made the point, since that email's exposure, no one from City has apologised for the email, apparently due to the stance that the emails were hacked. So therefore the contents, however unfortunate, are not to be acknowledged." And that has been the Man City stance on all of this, right the way through.
Yeah, right the way through. I mean, I actually even approached City before these leaks became publicly known in November 2018, because I had a leak about the leaks that were upcoming. And I actually put some of it to Gianni Infantino, who obviously was UEFA General Secretary back at the time of that 2014 settlement, now FIFA president, of course. And so I ran a piece actually a few days before Der Spiegel even published, which was Infantino talking generally about his own conduct, which I vaguely knew what the leaks might entail. Nothing as detailed as eventually emerged. Manchester City probably hoped that all this might fade away, and their initial position was not commenting, but I think it just picked up steam, particularly as more and more information came out through November 2018, you know, more of a sense of where the UEFA investigation would hold as well. So certainly public-wise, we've never heard any sort of strong defence. And of course, they can take a stance that this information was gained by means that they challenged because of the, you know, the person who is linked to it through Football Leagues is now awaiting trial in Portugal, not linked directly to the gaining of this information, but other information. But Football Leagues, as the bigger sense of all this, has been used in cases in Spain. You know, the criminal authorities there have used it to pursue cases. So, you know, the evidence has been sufficient for them to use as a point to investigate from.
So they will appeal this. This will go to CAS. I mean, one of the points they've made is this is a UEFA investigation and they've been found guilty in the eyes of UEFA. This whole thing is prejudicial. They're going to go to CAS. Amongst the other tactics they will put forward in front of CAS in the summer is one that they don't believe the process has been fair. And if UEFA has slipped up in any procedural way, you can bet that the City lawyers will be all over that. And then also I saw that it's going to use the results of an investigation against PSG not so long ago, where the prosecutor there decided that actually the value of the PSG sponsorships was more or less at the value that PSG had declared. And that was despite an independent valuation suggesting that they were worth much less, which is, you know, really tallies with the Man City situation in certain respects. Even I understand key figures, or I read key figures at UEFA were slightly alarmed by that decision. So I'm sure the Man City lawyers have looked at every available tactic here, and they'll be coming in a big way to CAS this summer. Is there any consensus yet as to how they may go at CAS, or is this thing way, do we not know enough at this stage?
Well, probably at this point, I should declare where I'm sort of interlinked to this, which is the fact Manchester City have already been to CAS once to try to get the case thrown out and seeking damages, claiming faults in the process, in part largely over reporters gaining information to report from. So because I've reported elements of the investigation in the last year or so, that has been protested by Manchester City, questioning the how that information is discovered. So they've already tried to find fault in the process in that regard. Obviously, we find that information, we report it accurately and fairly. Then moving on, they will obviously go to the Court of Arbitration Sport to again challenge who was judging them. And the prosecution side, the investigators at UEFA, are led by, it is an independent process. It does have independent figures like politicians, former Belgian Prime Minister at the head of it. They dispute a comment he made in the end of 2018 when he was talking generically about if there was a case, it would be something that had to be looked at, well, not comment on the specifics. Ultimately, then the judicial side that decides on the ban is led by a European judge. So these are figures who you would assume to have high probity and probably wouldn't necessarily like to read the fact that they're being effectively suggested to be part of a UEFA determined investigation and verdict. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. When it comes to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, you get arbitrators who decide on it, and both sides get to agree on effectively who is hearing the case.
Okay. As for matters on the field, Guardiola today said, "I will still be here even if they put us in League Two." So, I mean, he's come out fighting in a big way, and he has said, you know, he's going nowhere. The main players being talked about as potential flight risks include Raheem Sterling, who's also made a pledge of support, but the City, certainly until very recently, were looking for him to sign a £450,000 a week contract. De Bruyne at 29 years of age, and Laporte as well, were looking, City were looking to tie them down to £300,000 a week contracts. So those three seem to be the main flight risks, certainly in the eyes of the media. And again, over the weekend, there were reports that Juventus basically have an open invitation to Pep Guardiola. So as to what happens, Man City, the club, really, this whole thing could crumble incredibly quickly, regardless, to be honest, of what Pep is saying today.
Yeah, I mean, I would separate from what we're hearing today with what happened, say, at the end of the appeals process. Yeah. I mean, I don't think you'd expect necessarily even briefings from the manager and player sides basically threatening to leave or to walk out while this appeal's ongoing, because anything would obviously undermine the club. Let's look at it when players know, manager know if they'll be out of the Champions League for 2-1 or no seasons at all, ultimately end of the appeal process. And it'll be interesting to see if players do want to stick around, and it might depend on what age they're at, the status is, what their ambitions are, what they believe. Of course, City spending will be affected after the ban if they do serve the 2-year ban, because they won't have had that hundreds of million of UEFA income potentially for 2 years and the gate receipts and everything. So they'll have to comply with FFP when they re-emerge if they do serve the term 2-year ban. So they need to be abiding by the break-even rules then. So it does have a consequence of missing out the Champions League money beyond the prestige and the reputational damage as well.
Okay, Rob, listen, I know you're busy there. Thanks so much for making time for us. Appreciate it.
No, have a good evening.
There you are. That was Rob Harris. He was speaking to us outside Stamford Bridge earlier on this afternoon. And Rob will have just seen in the last few moments Manchester United take a 2-goal lead against Chelsea. Harry Maguire from a corner probably should have been sent off in the first half. Maguire is the general consensus, but he stayed on the pitch. And he headed home brilliantly, second header for United this evening, headed home from a corner, 71 minutes on the clock. United 2-0 up now against Chelsea. Chelsea themselves have had a goal disallowed, courtesy of VAR. So things could have been very different this evening. But as they stand with 20 minutes to go, United 2-0 up on Chelsea. Back in 1 second.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.
Welcome back. So Manchester United 2-0 up away to Chelsea, 77 minutes in the clock. Harry Maguire with the second goal. Martial, really good goal in the first half. Wan-Bissaka cross, Martial glancing header into the far corner. Harry Maguire getting his big old slab head through it, Dan. Oh, Chelsea have scored. 76 minutes in the clock. Olivier Giroud off the bench.
He's alive.
He sure is. Dan, would you believe it? Look at this for a stat to have out of hand. That is Giroud's 21st goal as a substitute in the Premier League. He is the second highest scoring substitute in Premier League history. Would you care to guess number one?
Solskjaer.
No. It's a good guess.
He'll be up there, surely.
It was a very good guess. Jermaine Defoe.
Oh. I would have had a few stabs before getting that one. Same. In fact, I'm not even sure if I would have.
Oh, no. VAR. Is it going to strike again for Chelsea? Possible offside being checked. And looking at the line,
it's
Olivier
one of
Giroud's, his big toe area, as Jim Beglin would call it, is offside.
No, it's going to kick off here if VAR goes Chelsea again and ruins your stat.
No, sorry, it's offside. This goal is not disallowed. It's not disallowed because of VAR. VAR has spotted an offside.
And the ref is doing like a gesture of like an off of a line on VAR as he did it there.
That's not even a. It's just his little toenail that's offside. Like no. A good chunk of his foot was offside.
No, I know. It's just like they've. You know, back before VAR, the referee just evened it up after disallowing the earlier one. I should let them have this one.
Harry Maguire should have been sent off, is the general consensus. Even Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher at halftime agreed on that. He definitely stabbed out at Chelsea players' groin area, as we've discussed, but scored a very good second goal.
Yeah.
This United team are funny, aren't they?
And he probably can't get retrospectively done now because the ref treated it at the time. Yeah, they are. They produced the odd big win. And it doesn't really change the overall.
It does change it a bit, though.
Does it?
Well, they're back to within, what, 2 points of Spurs, fifth place, 3 points of Chelsea in fourth. Like, the sense that this thing is in some kind of inevitable decline, that is interrupted when they do produce these big performances away from home against big teams. Oh, no, of course. But in terms of, like, the Manchester United hierarchy and this pleading among certain fans to go out and get Pochettino, it's very difficult to do that when Solskjaer can clearly point to some very good performances and some very big wins on occasion, i.e. like this one. Now, I know they lost to Burnley 2-0 at home the last time me and you were probably watching them in the
studio. It stops them getting sacked mid-season, maybe. It doesn't really change what happens come the end of it, does it?
Maybe, no. Well, it depends what ebb they're at come the end of the season, perhaps. It would be remiss of us to go through the football show without mentioning Harry Gregg. We did mention that at 7 o'clock, yeah. I should say, by the way, but he passed away at the age of 87. The Guardian obituary described him as one of the finest goalkeepers of his era, and I think everybody knows about his heroics at the Munich air disaster in 1958 when he, against the general advice, as you can imagine, he ran back towards the burning wreckage and pulled a number of people from the plane, including the pregnant wife of a Yugoslav diplomat, her daughter. He pulled Bobby Charlton from the wreckage, Dennis Violet, Albert Scanlon, Ray Wood, Jackie Blanchflower. Bobby Charlton and Dennis Violet were unconscious and he dragged them away by their trouser waistbands. Mm. And everybody that he pulled away from the wreckage survived. They owe their lives to Harry Gregg. So he was a very impressive fella. And then he went back. You'll remember they reached the FA Cup final in 58.
Yeah.
He went back and played in that FA Cup campaign, even though he had severe headaches.
He played 13 days later, yeah. I was just reading, Tommy Conlon did a brilliant interview with him in 2003. It's worth maybe people seeking it out there. It's a brilliant interview with Harry Gregg, because he actually, as much as Munich probably defined them, he didn't necessarily like speaking about it too much and took issue with a lot of the coverage of Munich and even felt that Manchester United didn't handle it very well afterwards. He took issue with books that were written, and Tommy has some great, like, his personality shines across in the piece. He didn't suffer fools. He could be blunt, but ultimately like a very good person, you know, and a heroic figure, but also spoke about how he had massive survivor guilt. And I think 40 years later, he met the wife of Roger Byrne, one of the players who died, and I think she said to him, you know, stop torturing yourself, you know. Wow. You know, and he sort of said that was a moment where he lost something that he'd been carrying with him the whole time, I guess. So it's a powerful piece, actually. It's worth seeking that out.
Tommy Conlon retweeted that. Yeah. I know Ocean Langan did an interview for Off the Ball back in 2008, which is on the website as well. So you won't be short of interviews with Harry Gregg if you're interested in checking those out. I do want to go to Gary Breen in conversation with Stephen Doyle. We brought you the Arsenal game yesterday, a 4-0 win for Arsenal. Kieran Clark injury is definitely an Irish cloud over that situation, but a 4-0 win for Arsenal. And as you'll hear, the two lads chatting post-match at the Emirates. Gary Breen, certainly cautiously optimistic about what he's seen from Arsenal.
Right, I'm here with former Republic of Ireland defender Gary Breen after what was, I suppose, a brilliant second half of football. Arsenal beating Newcastle United by 4-0 to go to 10th in the Premier League. We did speak during the commentary, Gary, about that first half and Arsenal just lacking that bit of cutting edge. So what changed for them to get those 4 goals in the second half?
I think just a bit more intensity. Obviously the message from Arteta, and it's not the first time we've seen it. They got outplayed in the FA Cup against Leeds. He gets his team in at half time, drills home to them what he requires. They come out, win comfortably, and they showed that today. Those 2 goals in quick succession just literally killed the game. And even in the first half, I was impressed with a lot of their play, their build-up play, that midfield rotation, how they were dominating possession. Up against a Newcastle team with 5 at the back, 4 in midfield, it's difficult to break that down. But I think the message certainly was to those wide players in the second half, Aubameyang, Pepe, be more decisive, make those runs from out to in, and it made a massive difference to the extent that Newcastle were literally hanging on in the end.
Young Saka at left back, we did speak during commentary as well about just how much bad luck Kieran Tierney's had with injuries, and especially coming in. I have to say, I thought he was going to do so well here at Arsenal. And he still could when he gets over these injuries. Yeah. But it's really been incredible the way Saka has come in there and been so influential on this Arsenal team at 18 years of age.
No, it's amazing, really. And I think as a young player, more than anything, you just want your opportunity. And if you get it, you've got to take it. Now, since Arsenal not been in Champions League and the Europa League over the last couple of seasons, the likes of Maitland-Niles came through, Reece Nelson, these guys got those games at that level, took their chance and built on it. Saka now looks like a player is capable of it. The energy, more than anything, he was driving forward late on in the game. Newcastle couldn't leave with his athleticism, but certainly that little bit of creativity on the edge of the box to nutmeg a player, drop a shoulder, cross the ball then for Pepe to get the goal. It was brilliant play. Listen, I like Tierney, and I think it's always difficult if you join a new club injured, you're struggling from the get-go. So he needs a summer of really just settling down, letting all these injuries heal, get healthy, and he will be an addition to this Arsenal squad, no doubt.
The midfield options now, there's so many of them now. Ceballos played really well today alongside Granit Xhaka, who has been rejuvenated underneath Mikel Arteta, you have to admit. And then they've also got Lucas Torreira, who came off the bench as well. Mesut Ozil played really well today. So around that central midfield area, they've got so many good options there, haven't they?
They've got options, but I would counter that by saying I don't think there's that many of those centre midfielders who can play under Arteta. If you think about how they want to play, and the only insight we have to Arteta is how Manchester City played. We don't think he's going to deviate much from that in terms of total football. Now, if you think about Torreira, Guendouzi, they can't play on the half turn in centre midfield. It's why when Arteta came in, he tried to rebuild the connection between Xhaka and the fans, because he knew that that's the one centre midfielder who can play on the half turn and make passes that break lines into the 10 area. Now, if you play Ozil, you have to have a regular supply of passes. And that's probably why Ceballos, who probably played in advanced midfield under Emery, played deeper today and played really well. He did. He tired toward the end, but that's expected. He's played so little football. But I'm not sure whether or not the likes of Guendouzi and Torreira will be Arteta's choice going forward.
Nicolas Pepe, we spoke about how little impact he was having in that first half, but in the second half it was quite different, wasn't it?
Ah, it was, and it was everything that you hoped he would bring when he made that sign. Listen, there's a massive tag attached to him, so it's difficult for a young player, massive pressure on his shoulders. But I think Arteta just gave him that message to say, listen, keep making these runs, showed him how to do it, and the ball will break. And if you keep attacking from out to in and get into that six-yard box, you'll get opportunities, and he did today. And I keep referencing it, and listen, it's the only way we can in terms of what Arteta is about as a rookie boss. The improvement that he has made to the likes of Sterling. Guardiola said that it was him who worked on him day in, day out. And Sterling suddenly went from a player who was erratic in 1v1 situations to a player who was so calm, so composed and got his goals. If he can do something similar to with Pepe, then that looks like they could have a good player on their hands.
Now back to your area of expertise, Gary, the back four. And I suppose Mustafi and Luiz, they didn't have a bad day today. No. But how much is that down to the lack of, you know, attacking from Newcastle in this game?
I think it says a lot. I think Newcastle did have chances. Joe Linton on that first half makes a run to the near post, should really score, doesn't hit the target. And I think Arteta will say the positives, that's two clean sheets now on the bounce, but the reality is Rodriguez should have scored for Burnley. Newcastle should have scored a couple today. That's not, as much as they've improved, that's not a back four that you can go forward with. I don't care what anyone says. I think he said about Mustafi in terms of trying to reintegrate him back into the team. He gives you so much. He's a wholehearted player, but he makes mistakes. We saw it again today. We talked about the way they set up, that Ceballos stays on that right-hand side to give Mustafi an easy pass to make. In that first half, the one occasion he wasn't there and he tried to make a pass, he passed into midfield, lost it, Newcastle broke, could have scored. That's the problem you have with this Arsenal squad, that there's so many individual errors and a lot sent around Mustafi, if you think about that goal we gave away against Chelsea.
But they've got options coming in. Cedric Suarez, yeah, of course, who we all know about, he's been playing for Southampton. Of course, Pablo, yeah, Mari, who's come in from Flamengo, and we're told that the Arsenal scouts had their eye on him for quite a while. They really made sure he's the right kind of player they wanted to bring into the club.
Well, I think he's someone that Arteta will want to bring into the club because he was at Manchester City with him as a younger centre-half. I think Arsenal supporters will probably look at his CV and think, well, hold on a minute, he's playing in the second division in Spain with Deportivo La Coruña. Then he goes to Flamengo and you're thinking, really, is he up to it? But Arteta's worked with him. If you think about the requirements of a centre-half for Arteta now, it's being able to play out from the back, and he gives you that. He's a left-footer. He's got a great switch of play in him and he's physically commanding. I think the worry with Mari is certainly his pace. He's not particularly quick, so that will be a concern in terms of that high line that Manchester City under Arteta and Guardiola like to have. But I think there's improvements. It was no surprise that as soon as the January window opened, it was two defenders that he brought in because he knows they're short. I like Cedric as right back, I always have, and I think he will be a really good addition. I think he'll put some real pressure on Bellerin in a way that Lichtsteiner couldn't at his age. I know he's a serial winner at Juventus, but he looked like he had done by the time he came to Arsenal last season. So, listen, there's competition for places and that bodes well.
Looking at Newcastle, I know Newcastle supporters will be disappointed going back up to the North East this evening after that game, but overall, do you think they're going to be happy enough with the way the season's gone so far?
I think the points are probably better than the performances. I think a lot of people in and around Newcastle have said that. I highlighted in commentary that Dubravka has been brilliant. I know he made a mistake, didn't look at his best today, but he saved them so many goals. And the problem that Newcastle have is finding a way to compete at this level with centre forwards or wide men who don't score goals. Now, we said about them going up against Rochdale in League One in the FA Cup, up against Oxford in the next round in League One. It took two games to beat both those teams. They just don't score enough goals and don't look like a goal threat. So that's the worry that he has, is that as much as people say, well, commit men forward, they can't. If they don't play a tight defensive structure, they get ripped to pieces. We saw it away at Norwich, we saw it away at Leicester. Brucey's done a brilliant job up to this point, bearing in mind how many injuries they've had.
I just want to ask you a couple of things related to Ireland. We'll start off first with Kieran Clark. Absolute disaster to see him going off today with that ankle injury. Look, we'll keep our fingers crossed. We'll say a few prayers that Kieran will be okay by the time the Slovakia game comes around. But, you know, Mick McCarthy, with the kind of players that we're looking to bring into the squad, he really can't afford to be losing those options at the back. I know Kieran's only played that New Zealand friendly since coming back into the international fold, but you would imagine that he would have had a good chance perhaps of coming into featuring those games against Slovakia.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think Mick has said, he's been quite vocal, that he's been impressed with how Kieran's been playing, that he's been a big part of why Newcastle have got those points. Like, it's a massive loss if it turns out to be as sinister as we're led to believe. But I think Mick's quite pragmatic in that, even at this stage, he will just say, listen, whatever players I've got, I'll make the best of it. He won't be lying awake at night with his fingers crossed, hoping everyone comes back. He'll just say, listen, whoever's fit is fit, and we'll go from there.
I spoke to Mick during the week. I'm going to throw a curveball here as you carry. I said to him, look, Mick, we've got five players there available to you to play in a back five. They're all playing in that similar system at their clubs. Enda Stevens, left wing back with Sheffield United. John Egan in the centre of a back three. Seamus Coleman has played on the right of a back three for Everton. Matt Doherty plays in that system with Wolves. And Shane Duffy's been playing in that system at times for Brighton. So why can't we play a back three with wing backs and therefore accommodating Coleman and Doherty? And Mick is like, well, we've only got four games to prepare. You know, we come in and all of a sudden the Slovakia games are top. And I'm thinking, I didn't get time to follow up on the question with him, but you don't need time. If the players are playing in that system in their clubs, surely they can just do it when they come into the international setup.
Yes, I would normally expect players at international level to be able to cope with being given a message and learning. Listen, there is enough time to work on it. He obviously doesn't believe that squad of players is capable of it.
I should add as well that he did say we tried against Switzerland and it didn't work. But that, you know, that game was just, it was going against us all the time.
This is not, Mick is not averse to playing a back five. I think when he initially got the job first time round, we started off with a back five, to the extent that I was playing in a back three with Roy at centre back in the middle of a three. I think that was in vogue at the time, where the dominant midfielders of Europe were playing deeper in that Beckenbauer role. So he will do it, but he'll look at the situation now. The only thing I will say is that if you think about the likes of Wolves, and notably, it centres around Doherty, doesn't it, in terms of that right wing-back role. We don't have centre midfielders like Neves and Coutinho who look after the ball. That's the problem. Mm. It's all well and good being expansive and playing, but if your midfielders give the ball away as often as ours do, you're in trouble. I think what is interesting, and this is what I hope, as much as we're talking about certain players, I've been really impressed with how McCarthy has done at Palace. Now, I'm not sure what the situation is, whether or not he's ready to come back, but even in big games against Manchester City, he played in a three-man midfield, just to the left-hand side. And his role there, bearing in mind up against Manchester City and how devastating De Bruyne is at making those underlapping runs down that side, he was so disciplined, so good. It was impressive. So I'm sure Mick would have noted that. Whether or not James is ready to come back, I know Mick is a big fan of his. He tried to sign him from Scotland for Wolves initially, but he chose to go to Wigan. So listen, we want all the players who can potentially play to be fit and healthy. There's still a couple of weeks to go as such until that has happened, but fingers crossed that they all are.
I remember doing a Palace game a couple of months ago, and just when McCarthy had come back into the reckoning, and I asked him about it, he kind of gave me the impression that he's only back, he's trying to get fit, and with the injuries that he's had, like, I have to say, I know our supporters, if he doesn't come in for that squad, if he's called up, a lot of our supporters might start getting a little bit, you know, losing their temper with James McCarthy. I can kind of see from his point of view, if he just wants to concentrate in club football from now till the end of the season and leave the international thing aside, you couldn't blame him, could you?
No, but there's a timing issue in terms of when you're just getting back into club football, you want to protect it. You're healthy for a first time in a long time, and he wants that to continue. But I think now there's been a period where he's played so much football now that he's ready. I think he's ready to cope with it. It's not going to be a physical decision. That's not it. It's a mental decision now, and whether or not he wants to risk coming back in and upsetting the momentum that he's got till the end of the season. But what do you play football for? You know, it's to play at the highest level, to play for your country. And I hope that at times where sometimes you can put that at the forefront of your mindset when you're not ready. I think he is ready now, and I believe that he would be a great addition to that squad.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that. Gary Breen in conversation with Stephen Doyle, pitch side of the Emirates yesterday. Arsenal beating Newcastle by 4-0. Meanwhile, at Stamford Bridge, they are into the final minute of 5 added minutes. Chelsea 0, Manchester United 2. United are going to go back to within 3 points of Chelsea in fourth and 2 points of Spurs in fifth. So suddenly, with Manchester City's predicament obviously not great and fifth spot being probably a gateway back into the Champions League, Manchester United are right back in the mix for Champions League football next season. Back in one sec.
That bit where it comes back from the ads is brought to you, unsurprisingly, by Paddy Power.
Well, it's gone full time. It's time for Bridge. It really probably was must-win territory for Manchester United from a Champions League point of view, and they have duly done that by 2-0. Harry Maguire and Martial with the goals. A few decisions could have gone either way. You would have to say the Maguire sending off definitely was had potential to be sent off. He wasn't ultimately, and Chelsea had 2 goals ruled out, courtesy of VAR. One for a push in the back, the other for offside. Both correctly. But Chelsea will probably feel a bit aggrieved nonetheless. That leaves United 3 points off Chelsea, 2 points off Spurs in fifth. Sheffield United also in the mix. But that race for Champions League spot now very interesting. You can download all the best bits from tonight's show. Andy Lee was on. He will be in Tyson Fury's corner on Saturday night for the Deontay Wilder fight. We also had Keith Wood and Rory O'Connor talking all things rugby. Offtheball.com/podcasts or iTunes or YouTube is where you'll get those pieces. And then tomorrow, OTBAM. From 7:30 on all our social media channels. Tom Dunn is on the way next. Good luck.
Give him a ball and he had a grass. He'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Ball and he had a spice. He'll give you a move with godly grace.